This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is hour number two of the show. The program is produced by Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. After World War II, seven of Adolf Hitler's closest associates were confined in Berlin's Spandau prison. The hope at the time, certainly among many, was that these men would become forgotten as they served out their sentences behind the walls of this prison. Instead, they continued to be the subject of fairly intense interest about them and about conditions in the prison. And they also were the center of a long struggle, a decades-long struggle, between the Soviet Union and the Western Allies, who all together jointly administered this prison. This was a battle that ended really only when the prison's last inmate, Rudolf Hess, died in 1987. And at that point, shortly thereafter, the prison was torn down. This morning in this part of the program, we'll be talking with historian Norman Goda about his book, Tales from Spandau, the subtitle Nazi Criminals and the Cold War. It is a book that is full of details about who these men were, how this prison was run, conditions there, controversy about them and about the prison. Also contains a brief history of the Nuremberg trials, all between the covers of the book. It is published by the Cambridge University Press and is out now if you'd like to take a look at it. Norman Goda is interested in a number of subjects and teaches courses on Nazi Germany and the Holocaust, also the history of war crimes trials and the history of intelligence. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief when they call in so that we can keep the program moving and accommodate as many different callers as possible. But, of course, anyone who is interested in calling is welcome to do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-9455 or WILL. That makes it any easier. Toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Goda, hello.
Here.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate it. There's much here that we could talk about, but perhaps let me ask a very general kind of question, and you pose it in the introduction to your book. I think one could understand that someone who is interested in studies, writes about the subject that you do, would be interested in this history. But for a lot of other people, that it would be a footnote to the history of the Cold War. Why is it that you think that this story, as you put it here, why is a story about seven prison sentences important?
It has to do, I think, with the legacy of not only this trial, but other war crimes trials. Thousands of Germans were put on trial after World War II. The whole idea of war crimes trials received an impetus in the 1990s, thanks to the war in former Yugoslavia and the genocide in Rwanda, and has most recently been seen in the trial of Saddam and his associates. And how we remember war crimes trials and how we remember defendants has an awful lot to do with how we remember the history of particular events. And how we remember the history of particular events gets at things like national identity, which play back into international relations. And in the Cold War, the identity of Germans, the sort of place of Germany in the Nazi period and then in the Cold War world was a subject of very fierce debate, not only between Germans themselves, but also between the Soviets on the one hand and the Allies on the other.
Mm-hmm. As you point out, after the war, there were a number of people who were charged with crimes, were tried, and were sent to prison.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that got the trial and the people that got the most attention was this group of two dozen high leaders in the Third Reich, among them these seven people that you talk about in the book and the seven that served time in Spandau. One of the questions is that, you know, when you look at this most prominent group, a lot of these people were sentenced to die and were executed.
Mm-hmm.
How is it that these seven managed to escape execution. One particularly asked that question when you look at, for example, the attitudes of the Soviet Union. Russians felt that everyone should have been executed. They didn't think that there should have been much in the way of exceptions at all.
Right.
How is it that these seven managed to escape capital punishment?
Well, at this particular trial, which was sort of the granddaddy of all war crimes trials, the trial of the major war criminals, all four of the major powers which defeated Nazi Germany sat in judgment. You had Soviet judges, American judges, French and British judges as well, and they reached their verdicts in a somewhat flawed fashion. Really through horse trading sessions. They tried to weigh the evidence as best they could. They tried to compare the defendants to one another, and they came up with sentences that were ultimately varied. You can make the argument, as the Soviets did, that all of them should have been executed, but there were simply different views of different defendants. Rudolf Hess was thought to be mentally unbalanced, and so he received a life sentence rather than a death sentence. Albert Speer, Hitler's armaments minister, was thought to have been rather contrite at Nuremberg, and so the Allied judges voted that he shouldn't receive a death sentence either, and so the compromise in his case was 20 years.
And I think, as you point out, these individuals were all different. We have the one arguably the worst would have been Hess, the one who was most highly placed. Mm-hmm. Some of them were civilians who, though, had important connections high up in the Third Reich. A couple of them were military men. They were both admirals. One of them, the person who was, in fact, named to be the successor to Hitler, who briefly, I suppose, was. And so it raises a range of questions about, particularly, I suppose, about how it is you deal with uniformed soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
Who were, when there was a question about did they or did they not commit war crimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, there were uniformed soldiers who were, in fact, executed at Nuremberg. The chief of the German High Command, Wilhelm Keitel, was found guilty on all four counts and executed, and the chief of staff of the High Command, Alfred Jodl, was also found guilty on all four counts and executed. These two naval officers were found guilty on certain counts and not guilty on others. One of them, Erich Raeder, who was Hitler's naval commander-in-chief until 1943, received a life sentence. He actually got out in 1955 due to health reasons, which is a whole other story. Karl Dönitz, who was an absolute devotee of Hitler, who was surely guilty of a number of very serious crimes, received a 10-year sentence, even though he was Hitler's successor, simply because the judges came to the conclusion that since he was Raeder's subordinate until 1943, his sentence should be shorter than Raeder's was, and so they compromised on 10 years. But yeah, it's a problem in dealing with military figures, because after wars you have very strong and very vocal and very powerful veterans lobbies. West Germany was no exception to this, and the finding of criminality of one's commanders suggests very strongly that the entire war was criminal and that everyone in the armed forces, to one degree or another, was engaged in a criminal exercise. And so sentencing senior military commanders is always problematic politically.
Mm-hmm. I suppose, too, there is one large question that I'm sure that the Allies had to confront, and perhaps one continues to confront it when you talk about people who are judged to be war criminals, and that is, if you have someone like this, and if you make the decision not to execute them, you at the same time don't want them to be a rallying point. Well, in this particular case, they didn't want these people to be a rallying point for neo-Nazi activities.
Mm-hmm.
So what they would have just liked it, what they would have liked to do was, in effect, for them to disappear. But the fact of the matter is they were still alive. So the question was, how do you in effect make them disappear when they're still alive and everybody knows where they are?
Yeah, you can't. The hope here at Spandau was that this was an inconspicuous prison sort of on the outskirts of Berlin, that no visitors were allowed, very few letters were allowed in and out, and so the inmates were to become forgotten men. The problem with that, of course, is that each of these prisoners, not all of them, but most of them, had very vocal advocates in West German society and sometimes outside of Germany. There was a very strong lobby in Great Britain that argued that the naval commanders ought to be released to ease Germany's integration into NATO. German veterans made an argument that soldiers could never march by the cell windows of their former commanders, and therefore it would be very hard for West Germany to join the Atlantic Alliance as long as German commanders from the last war were in prison. And in fact, German military commanders that were being held by the British and the Americans in Western Germany were released over the course of the 1950s, partly due to this kind of pressure from veterans groups and the West German government.
At the end of the war, the Allies knew that they would have need of prisons to house war criminals, and certainly this would have been a possibility. This was a prison that was built in the 19th century and had the potential to hold hundreds of people.
Mm-hmm.
How is it that it turned out that there were only seven?
This is one of the interesting things about the prison, is that almost at every turn you're faced with a terrific irony, and one of the ironies of Spandau is really the building itself. It was chosen in 1946 because it was available. The damage to buildings in Berlin, including prisons, was very severe, and so the Allies and the Soviets basically had to find a prison that was more or less intact that could be made secure very quickly. The Soviets didn't want to use a prison in their sector of Berlin, probably because they didn't want additional Allied listening posts in the eastern sector, and so it had to be in the west. So one of the criteria was that the place was still standing and could be repaired fairly easily. And one of the criteria already in 1946 was that they not use a place that was kind of a place of sacrifice for opponents of Hitler. Plotzensee prison was in fact considered at one point, and it was more or less intact, but this was where the resistors who attempted the assassination of Hitler in 1944 were strung up and hung on meat hooks and that sort of thing, and Plotzensee remains a museum to this day. So they wound up choosing Spandau, and you're right. It was a prison with something like 125 cells. There were over 500 prisoners there at the time for petty offenses like black marketeering and that sort of thing. And you can say, well, this is a huge prison for seven people, but at the time, it was expected that there would be more international war crimes trials and that the eventual prison population might be as high as 150. At the end of the Nuremberg trial, the Allies decided to sort of go their separate ways with trials and specifically not to work with the Soviets anymore on joint trials. And so these were the only prisoners to have been tried by an international tribunal. And so the place wound up holding seven prisoners and then eventually one, Rudolf Hess, for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Norman Goda. He is professor of history at Ohio University, where he teaches courses and writes and does research on the history of World War II, Nazi Germany, the Cold War, and his book is titled Tales from Spandau, Nazi Criminals and the Cold War. It is published by the Cambridge University Press. Questions welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The method of administering this prison was unusual, at least in the sense that it was jointly run by the four powers that ran Berlin, the Russians, the Americans, the British, and the French, and that what was unusual was that they jointly ran the prison, and they did it by taking turns. Mm-hmm. Each of the four powers ran the prison for a month. So the British would run it for a month, the Americans would run it for a month, the French would run it for a month, the Russians would run it for a month, and it would rotate. And they had, each of the four powers had administrators, they had guards, they had everything that it took to run the place. They had these four complete staff, sets of staff, and it would change every month.
Mm-hmm. The only thing that really changed every month, the interior of the prison, that is to say the interior guards themselves, were always mixed. And so you always had a mixed administration within the cell block itself. But the exterior guard, that is the troops that man the towers and the perimeter and that sort of thing, did rotate on a monthly basis the same way that other organizations in Berlin were to have rotated on a monthly basis had the Soviets not tried to end four-power administration in 1948. So, for instance, the U.S. months each year were April, August, and December. The Soviet months were March, July, and November, and so forth. And at the first of every month, there would be a rather elaborate changing of the guard ceremony. And if it was November, for instance, the Soviets would assume security duties for the prison. So in those Soviet months, if you think about it, you had seven German prisoners being guarded by a mixed nationality team in the cell block, which in turn was being guarded by a Soviet external guard, which in turn was being guarded by the British Army because the prison was in their sector. But these kinds of things were not entirely uncommon in Berlin because it was a city under four-power military rule.
Mm. And you talked about the fact that obviously that the prison operated this way for quite a long time, and in the last 20 years of the prison's operation, there was only one inmate.
That's true.
Rudolf Hess. There must have been points at which representatives of the power said, This doesn't make a whole lot of sense, that either we could simplify the operation of the prison, or perhaps that the last inmate could be confined somewhere else.
Yeah, it happened all the time. In fact, the British were tired of the Spandau arrangement almost as soon as it started in 1947 because the prison was in their sector. And after the Berlin blockade in particular, and then after the Berlin Wall was built in 1961, it became a political embarrassment to be working with the Soviets in Western Berlin to guard seven prisoners, and then for 20 years, eventually one. There was also sort of the popular notion that Hess was mentally unbalanced, that he was insane, that he belonged in a sanitarium, and that sort of thing. And, numerous overtures were made by the three Western powers, but also by the British themselves on numerous occasions to have Hess moved to a sanitarium, and then as he entered his late 80s and 90s, simply to be remanded to the custody of his family. And consistently, the Soviets refused. Part of it was vindictive. They had strongly felt that Hess ought to hang. Part of it was that the Soviets had always felt that Hess was part of a put-up job with British intelligence during the war to sort of combine British and German forces against the Soviet Union in one way or another. This was their explanation for Hess's famous flight to Great Britain in May of 1941, but partly because they suspected, and I think the Soviets were right about this particular issue, that Hess would become a rallying point for neo-Nazis. He was still very much a devotee of Hitler, still very much convinced that there were Jewish conspiracies everywhere and this sort of thing. And in fact, the sort of march to Hess's grave by thousands of neo-Nazis every year up until 2004 kind of bears the Soviets out on that particular point. In any event, they weren't. He was going to serve every sentence of every second of his sentence. And this he did until he eventually hanged himself in 1987.
Yeah. We have a caller here to join us, and others who are listening are welcome to call with questions here. The caller is on a cell phone in Milford, Illinois. That's our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. Another very interesting show. I have a somewhat unrelated question, but just something I was always curious about and was wondering perhaps if your guest could comment, and then I'll go ahead and ring off. Just talking about prisoners and war crimes, I always was curious as to von Braun and his involvement with the V-1 and V-2 rockets, if he was under any consideration for war crimes, but because of his vast knowledge and his use to the U.S. Rocket program, if that was somehow skirted or if that was ever given any consideration. And I'll go ahead and ring off. Thanks.
Okay.
Yeah, well... German engineers and rocket scientists were a valuable commodity after World War II, partly because of their knowledge of and everything from jet propulsion to rocket science to other scientific things along those lines. And there was sort of a race after World War II between the Soviets and the Americans to get a hold of these people and employ them in one capacity or another. And von Braun was one of the people who was allowed into the United States where he enjoyed, you know, a successful career afterwards as an aerospace engineer.
Well, again, I hope it gets to the question of the caller. We're almost at our midpoint here. Questions are continue to be welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Norman Gota. He is professor of history at Ohio University. And we're talking about his book, Tales from Spandau, Nazi Criminals and the Cold War. It is published by Cambridge University Press. Perhaps we could talk a little bit about the daily life in the prison. Certainly conditions for the prisoners were strict, more strict than perhaps others who were serving for somewhat similar crimes in other prisons. There was no corporal punishment, but there were very strict rules about what they could do. There were limitations on the contact they could have with the outside world. There were limitations on the contact they could have with their families. There was a constant concern about the possibility that they might attempt suicide, so that conditions for them would have been uncomfortable, to say the least. What was life like?
It was prison life. You know, I've never been to prison myself, thank goodness, so I can't really compare it to anything. But, you know, it was very regimented. There was a schedule that they followed each day. They got up at 6. They cleaned the cell block. They were allowed to go out and work in a garden that was set up, you know, weeding, planting things, that sort of thing. They went and ate lunch. They could read. They could smoke. And eventually they went to bed each night. There was a chapel service for them. On Saturdays, they were allowed to write and receive one brief letter each month, and they could receive a visitor for a half an hour each month, and this was always somebody from their families. The interesting thing is that for the Soviets, this was always a security issue, and before the prisoners arrived in Berlin in 1947, the Soviets were absolutely adamant that for their entire term, whether it be 20 years, whether it be 10 years, or whether it be life, the prisoners should serve out their time in absolute solitary confinement, where they would literally never leave their cells. The food would be brought to them, medical care would come to their cells, but they were to have absolutely no interaction with each other. And partly this was punitive, because the Soviets had badly wanted to hang them all, but partly the Soviets were genuinely afraid of all of these inmates. Most of them had been very important people in the Third Reich. Albert Speer had been a minister of state. Walter Funk had been a minister of state. Hess had been a minister and was secretary of the Nazi Party. Dönitz was Hitler's successor. Raeder had been a senior military figure, and von Neurath had been foreign minister. And so what the Soviets saw with these seven people was sort of a shadow government, which, if allowed to plan, if allowed to talk, if allowed to have contact with the outside world, could possibly bring Nazism back to power. And I think what the Soviets were probably considering was that in 1924, Hitler, Hess, and several other leading Nazis were in prison themselves, in Landsberg prison in Bavaria after Hitler's failed coup of 1923. They enjoyed very comfortable conditions at the time. They received a lot of visitors. They conducted correspondence. Hitler found time to dictate Mein Kampf, at least the first part of it, to Rudolf Hess in 1924. And, you know, the point being that the time in prison in 1924 was not the final act at all. And so the Soviets were partly rather triumphalist in 1945, 46, and 47, but partly scared to death that these people could come to power again. In the end, the British wouldn't accept the prisoners into their zone, into their sector of Berlin, unless the prisoners were allowed to go outside and do some sort of productive work every day, and unless the prisoners could have a chapel service once a week. And eventually the Soviets relented on this point, but the Soviets, for the life of the prison, tried very, very hard to keep the prisoners from speaking to one another. Mail was heavily censored. It went through Soviet intelligence people who were stationed at the prison to see what the prisoners were writing and what kinds of things they were receiving and that sort of thing. Of course, you know, once Hess is there by himself and once he becomes increasingly a geriatric, the prison sort of takes on the characteristics of a high-security nursing home. You know, once he's in his 80s and 90s, you know, he's able to choose his own menu. He has a more comfortable cell. He goes for walks every day. He watches a lot of television and that sort of thing. But for the first half of the prison's life, the Soviets were convinced that they were dealing with very dangerous prisoners in their own right.
Well, and certainly it seems that the Soviets were always much more concerned with a very strict enforcement of the rules, less so than the Allies. I think that initially when there was the total group, the seven, I'm sure that the months that they looked forward to least were those that were administered by the Russians.
Right. Yeah. There was always a certain trepidation right before March, right before July, and right before November, because this meant that the Soviet Guard was going to take over. The Soviet Guard was very heavily armed. There were always concerns that someone would try to break these people out of prison one way or another. And so the Soviets, were armed with loaded, fully automatic Kalashnikov machine guns, and they had additional clips on the towers as well. The Allies were never that heavily armed simply because they didn't expect anything. And, they just figured that guarding men who were increasingly becoming geriatric and had all kinds of health problems wasn't going to be that difficult. But the power that had the external guard also supplied the food for that month. They just didn't care for the Russian food. There was less of it. It was the same food that the Soviet troops got, but when the Russians were there, you basically got a lot of boiled cabbage, and when the Americans and French were there, you just got better food.
We will take a couple of calls now. We have next someone in Charleston, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. I want to ask about the immediate post-war civil policing structure. I understand from some old veterans groups, organizations I belong to, having served in Germany in the 60s, was that there was a constabulary force formed, I guess, late 45, 46, 47, of American GIs who were, in effect, made civilian cops to patrol the streets of various cities there, and that, and kind of harking back to the situation in Iraq with the Ba'athist party members who are causing all kinds of problems over there, that there was some level of that kind of activity, unreconstructed Nazis or whatever, SS and the like, in Germany during that time period. I was wondering if you could comment about just how severe that problem was, or if there were any parallels between it and today, and when did the constabulary force, in effect, go out of business and revert to German civilian police enforcement?
You know, you had different layers of government in Berlin. From almost the very start, there was a municipal Berlin government with a Lord Mayor and all of that. But he really served under the four powers themselves, and so Berlin was really under four-power military rule. And the four powers had a public safety division, which really took care of issues like law and order, keeping the streets safe, black marketeering, and that sort of thing. There was always a concern that you would have, you know, neo-Nazi activity, well, not neo-Nazi, but unreconstructed Nazi activity in 1945, but it was never at the level that we see in Iraq today. You know, there were very minor acts from time to time, and most of the people who were arrested and who were imprisoned in the Western sectors anyway were there for black marketeering and that kind of thing. Now, of course, the Soviet sector was a whole different ball of wax, and the Soviets were going after anybody who they thought could be a political threat and were a lot more aggressive.
But the constabulary force, was there one? And
oh yeah, yeah. No, I mean, they were still dressed as American troops, you know, in the U.S. sector, but they did have to assume duties for law and order and that sort of thing. And the prisons, though technically under the rule of the German Lord Mayor in Berlin, if they were in the American sector, then they were in effect requisitioned by the American Army itself.
And when did this constabulary force in effect revert over to the German police units and so on?
It never completely goes away in theory as a matter of law until Berlin actually becomes the capital of Germany and the Allies and the Soviets definitively pull out. But over time, you know, after 1949, the Germans themselves, the Berliners themselves, assume more and more of these duties, with the Allies just kind of assuming oversight.
And I take it that's what occurred elsewhere in Germany as well.
Yeah. Well, in elsewhere in Germany, in 1951, Germany goes over to a different kind of occupation regime. In 1949, West Germany becomes a semi-sovereign state, and military government in effect ends. And you have Allied high commissioners to oversee German policy. And in 1955, the high commissioners become ambassadors, and relations are that much more normalized as a result. But Berlin itself always remains under four-power rule.
Right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. About 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Norman Gota. He's professor of history at Ohio University. He teaches courses on Nazi Germany and the origins of World War II, as well as the Cold War and the history of war crimes trials. He is the author of the book Tales from Spandau, Nazi Criminals and the Cold War. That's the subtitle. And the book is published by the Cambridge University Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Champaign County, here where we are. That's line one. Hello.
Hi. I realize it's a different book, but the caller about Wernher von Braun was, there's a lot more to that story, and I'll mention the book from 88, Blowback, by Christopher Simpson, the first full account of America's recruitment of Nazis and its disastrous effects on our domestic and foreign policy. And effects on the Cold War. Just some of the key words that one can search for is the Galen Group, where they recruited the Nazi intelligence, the rat line that moved Nazis to South America, where they were used in repressing people down there, Klaus Barbie and the famous cocaine coup. It's all under sort of Operation Paperclip, which was the CIA's name for using these very useful resources, as you might have put it. So it seems like Spandau is sort of a show place, perhaps distracting people in some way. I mean, some of these people who were agitating for release of these people knew that these other people were being recruited.
it's a wonderful point you make. And in fact, you do have two policies going on at the same time. One is very above board and one is hidden. I'm familiar with Chris's book. I worked with Chris on a couple of other projects a couple of years ago. You have in the U.S. Army and in the U.S. intelligence service a couple of different things going on. On the one hand, you have the legal offices that are, very much going after war criminals and are very sincere in trying to carry through proper punishment and denazification. And if you look at, sort of beyond Nuremberg, what you see is an awful lot of trials being conducted by the United States, Britain, and France, and even extradition of German war criminals or war criminal suspects from the U.S. zone, even to places like Poland, as late as 1947 to answer for their crimes. I don't think that the United States is necessarily soft on war criminals after the war, because the numbers sort of back up a very sincere effort to see that they're punished. Now, if they're in American prisons, they were all let out prematurely, although the very worst of them were hanged. Beyond that, you have other American agencies that have different agendas. And immediately after the war, it's not really the CIA, but rather the Army Counterintelligence Corps that uses former German officers and former SS officers and former Gestapo personnel sort of for what they know about local communist activity, what they know about the Soviets, and that sort of thing. And what I've kind of found in another book I worked on called U.S. Intelligence and the Nazis with Richard Brightman and Tim Naftali is that there isn't a really set U.S. policy directed from above aimed at using war criminals for intelligence purposes. More often than not, it kind of happens on the local level where a junior intelligence official sort of gets suckered in by a former Gestapo officer or something like that. He pays for information. The relationship continues perhaps longer than it should. Now, of course, with the scientists and Operation Paperclip is mostly about the scientists. You know, this is something that's directed from pretty senior levels in the United States. And the Galen organization was really an army and then a CIA operation. Galen was Hitler's chief of military intelligence for the Eastern Front at one point during the war, and he was hired by the U.S. Army and then passed off to the CIA, and he set up his own intelligence network where he hired at least 100 former SS officers with very unsavory pasts. But in that particular case, I think it's more a case of the U.S. Army and then the CIA kind of losing control of Galen and not really keeping a close enough eye on who he was hiring. But you're right. There are a lot of different currents going on at once.
Yeah, I appreciate the comments of the caller. Again, I have several other people and about 10 minutes left, so hope you will forgive me if I go on here to someone else. And the next is Champagne in line two. Hello.
Hi. When I was in high school, I had a teacher who was a former enemy alien who came here to the United States to teach. He was of the opinion that the reason why they had him locked up in Spandau Prison was not so much so they would talk, but so that they wouldn't talk. And I'm curious if your guests can speculate on what possibly they could have said.
The seven war criminals themselves, what they could have said. Well, there was always concern on the part of the Soviets what they were going to say, and particularly what Hess was going to say. You know, the Spandau prisoners were able to keep notebooks and jot down notes, sort of like spiral binders today. And the Allies and the Soviets would sort of read through these comments and then give them new notebooks when they were filled and destroy the old notebooks. But I'm not sure what any of them could have said that would have concerned the Allies unduly one way or the other. I mean, the Allies very much, as a matter of politics, after, say, 1955, really wanted to shut the place down.
All right, let's go to Urbana Line 3. Hello.
Hi, I'm curious about Admiral Dönitz.
Mm-hmm.
When Hitler was dead and Dönitz took over or took charge, I remember the British radio announcing it, and they called Dönitz a fighting man of impeccable professional reputation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how did he get accused of war crimes? What were they?
He was accused of several things at Nuremberg. One of the things he was accused of was helping to launch an aggressive war. One thing he was accused of was war crimes on the high seas, namely unrestricted submarine warfare and the non-rescue and or killing of shipwrecked crews. And then on top of that, he was accused of handing over commandos, Allied commandos, to the SS so that they could be summarily shot. So there was plenty there to convict Dönitz on. And Dönitz was aware that German submarine captains had stood trial after World War I. For torpedoing unarmed merchant ships and that sort of thing. And so he had his crews on numerous occasions kind of falsify their own records. So it's hard to know exactly what his policies were from following the war diaries of the submarine commanders themselves. But there are a lot of orders, or at least a few orders, from Dönitz that went out when he was submarine commander and then when he was commander-in-chief of the Navy that left it very vague. He was absolutely adamant that German submarine crews not rescue shipwrecked crews. But the language was very vague as to whether they could go ahead and kill shipwrecked crews as well. And there's a very famous case where a British ship was sunk and the crew was killed, partly so that they wouldn't give away the positions of German submarines. There was plenty there to convict him on.
Okay.
All right, thank you. Let's go to line four. This is a caller in Chicago. Hello.
Good morning. I'm a little late to the show, so I'll try and hurry up. I actually have two questions. One, how did the Berlin blockade affect the way prisoners were being treated, especially when the Cold War between Russia and the Allies was heating up or getting colder, I should say?
Mm-hmm.
And two, isn't it true that Admiral Dönitz's lawyers wrote Admiral King when he was being accused of unrestricted submarine warfare, and they said, well, didn't you do the same thing to the Japanese in the Pacific? And he wrote back and said, yes, we did.
Yeah, that was actually Chester Nimitz. Yeah, why don't I take that question first? Dönitz actually had a pretty good lawyer, a former naval judge named Otto Kranzbühler, who didn't bring Nimitz in to testify, but did get a signed affidavit from Nimitz where Nimitz said, yes, in principle, we went to unrestricted submarine warfare in the Pacific, and in principle, we did not rescue crews if there was a danger to the ship itself, if there was a danger to the American submarine and its crew itself. And this he kind of offered, Dönitz's lawyer kind of offered as proof that the nature of war had changed and that submarine commanders did what submarine commanders had to do. The problem was that Dönitz didn't just go to unrestricted submarine warfare. He also made it understood that it would be appreciated if shipwrecked crews did not return home, because, as he put it, the Americans could keep building more ships, but they couldn't keep training more crews, and it would be harder and harder to get people to serve in the merchant marine as the war went on, once it got out that merchant seamen never made it home. And in fact, the proportion of merchant seamen killed to merchant seamen who served was very, very high. Nimitz also didn't hand people over to the FBI for summary shooting. He didn't use concentration camp labor in the United States. You know, these were kinds of things that Dönitz did. The argument of unrestricted submarine warfare held to a point, but there were other things that Dönitz was responsible for. And very quickly, your second question, your first question, the blockade was very fascinating, because the Soviets clearly wanted the Allies to quit Berlin, but at the same time, the Soviets themselves were not going to quit Spandau Prison, and once it was clear that the Allies were not leaving, the Soviets also made it clear that they weren't going to leave Spandau. And it's very odd. If you read the sort of duty logs of the prison for the months of the blockade, you would never know that a blockade was going on and that an airlift was going on and that the threat of World War III was out there. The guard kept changing during the blockade. The prisoners kept with their routine. The barber kept coming in and leaving. The pastor kept coming in and leaving. And the Soviets made it very clear that these prisoners were so important to them that regardless of what broke down in Berlin, Spandau Prison was going to keep working.
We're almost out of time, though I do want to hear at the end have you talk at least maybe for a minute about what happened to the building after Hess died, because I think it's, an interesting little feature of this story. The Allies were very concerned that this place not become a shrine for Nazi sympathizers, and so the building was torn down rather completely.
Yeah, absolutely, completely. And in fact, all of the documents were burned, too. Each document had a Spandau Allied prison stamp, and so the Soviets were afraid that these would become souvenirs. And so all of the documents were burned, all 85,000 pages in a big bonfire. Fortunately, they microfilmed them, and those were the records that I used partly to write the book. But there was great concern that the prison itself would become a shrine, and so it was agreed years before Hess died that once he did die, the prison would be completely demolished. And this is what happened after Hess died. The building was essentially pulverized. The wood was taken, mixed with other wood so that it would lose its Spandau identity, and then it went back into the private building sector in Berlin. And the stone walls were pulverized as well, and then truck after truck after truck took the bricks to Britain's Air Force Base, Gatow Air Force Base in West Berlin, and the entire prison in its pulverized form was poured into this great hole, which was then filled in and covered with trees. So the prison itself was buried after the last inmate was buried, and there's a shopping center there now with a parking lot and all of that sort of thing, and there's absolutely no reminder or plaque or you know anything that you could point to at the place that would give you any indication that the prison ever existed.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to stop here, and if for people who are interested in reading more, and as I say, that there are the stories of who these seven men were, what their confinement was like, what prison life was like, a brief history of the Nuremberg trial. If you're interested in finding out more about that, learning more about that, look for this book. It's Tales from Spandau, Nazi Criminals and the Cold War. It's published by the Cambridge University Press by our guest, Norman Goda. He is professor of history at Ohio University. And Professor Goda, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.